NATO could soon get a little bigger. Turkey is dropping its objections to letting Sweden in the alliance. Many in Sweden don't like the idea.
It's saddening, and it means that Sweden will contribute to make the world more polarized and militarized.
Also today, why the punishing summer weather is even more concerning for climate scientists like Michael Mann.
In some respects, the models have actually underestimated the impact that climate change is having.
And the global community is ready to help in Sudan, but big barriers stand in the way.
There's no humanitarian fix for what is right now a military conflict.
USAID head Samantha Power weighs in, plus the vanishing art of traditional salt farming in Mexico, producing white gold that's more flavorful and better for you. The stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Welcome to the show. NATO, the 74-year-old military alliance, looks ready to expand. After months of standing in the way, Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has now reversed course, saying he would agree to support Sweden's bid to join NATO. President Joe Biden welcomed the news. He's one of the Western leaders in Lithuania today for the opening day of a NATO summit. With Sweden now expected to become the 32nd member of NATO, it ends more than two centuries of political neutrality for the country. From Stockholm, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry kicks things off.
It's a good day for Sweden. Those were the words of the Swedish Prime Minister last night as his country's bid to join NATO now looks almost certain. I'm very happy, Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson told reporters, that the three of us have shaken hands on this. The three of them being the Turkish president, NATO's general secretary and the Swedish leader. A major sticking point for Turkey was the presence of exiled pro-Kurdish dissidents here in Sweden. News of Erdogan's reversal came last night. Sweden says it will continue with its counter-terrorism cooperation against the Kurdistan People's Party, also known as the PKK. Turkey calls members of the group terrorists. More than 150,000 Kurds live in Sweden, and many say all the back and forth between Turkey and Sweden in the last year has been really unsettling for the community. I meet writer Kurdo Baksi in a Kurdish restaurant in southern Stockholm.
You know, when you speak about Kurdish food, it's also a little bit Greek food, a little bit Turkish food, Persian food, Arabic food. In the Middle East, everybody says, this food is mine, but you shouldn't trust them.
Baksi came to Sweden from Turkey as a Kurdish refugee more than 40 years ago. His father and grandfather were both outspoken defenders of Kurdish rights in Turkey, and Baksi has followed in their footsteps. He's a strident critic of President Erdogan, and he says he hasn't been back home in more than a decade.
I will be arrested and tortured. Yeah, I think so.
When Sweden announced its intention to join NATO in May of last year, Turkey made several demands. Among them was a list of names of Kurdish political dissidents that Turkey wanted Sweden to extradite for prosecution. The Swedish government said extradition decisions are up to the courts. Even so, Kurdo Baksi says, that demand by Turkey spread fear through the Kurdish community here in Sweden.
Hundreds and hundreds of Kurds called me, please, am I in the list? You are the only one who can know that. So I have to say to the people, no, you are not in the list.
You were able to check and see? You were able to find out?
Yes, I find the name. Don't ask me how. I'm a journalist.
In some ways, Baksi says, Sweden's membership in NATO may end up helping the Kurdish exile community by boosting their recognition globally. But he is worried about the lengths the Swedish government may go to satisfy Turkey. Last night, the NATO Secretary General said Sweden would help support Turkey's application to join the European Union. That's something the Turkish government has been pursuing for years, with some backing from Stockholm.
Sweden has always been, in principle, a strong supporter of Turkish EU accession. And in the early years, Sweden was, one of Turkey's strongest supporters.
Paul Levin is director of the Institute for Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. At this point, he says, Turkey's prospects for EU membership are a long way off. Some say all this hard bargaining by Turkey in the past 12 months wasn't really about Sweden at all. But Levin says he's not so sure about that.
I think that this was never only about the PKK in Sweden. I do think that that was a real issue for Turkey. The PKK is an issue that many Turks feel very strongly about, passionately about.
Still, Levin says US involvement in the talks in recent days probably helped push Turkey over the finish line. Today, Washington said the transfer of F-16 fighter jets to Turkey will go ahead. Opinion polls in Sweden show that a strong majority of Swedes are in favour of their country joining NATO. On the streets of Stockholm this afternoon, though, some people I speak with seem ambivalent.
I think I'm for, but I'm not really sure.
Why are you not sure?
Hard to tell. We had this independence forever, so maybe that's why I'm not sure.
That's Hasse Astrovalla, who's from the Swedish capital. Hugh van Barke, who's also from Stockholm, tells me he's not convinced either.
I think the government we have right now are sticking their fingers in everything because they benefit from it instead of looking what's best for the country. So that's why I'm hesitant to joining.
There's also a minority here in Sweden that's solidly against joining NATO.
It's hasty and saddening, and it means that Sweden will contribute to make the world more polarized and militarized.
Kerstin Barjo is with the Swedish Peace and Arbitration Society. The walls of her office are covered in posters with slogans like, "War is not the answer." Barjo says the Swedish government hasn't explained what this decision will actually mean for her country.
Will we have military bases? There are so many decisions we have no idea of. Who will cover all the costs now?
But at the NATO summit in Vilnius today, member states had already moved on to the next issue. And that's whether Ukraine should now be considered as the next possible member of the military alliance. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in Stockholm.
In the Knesset in Israel today, opposition lawmakers being told to quiet down after yelling the word shame. Anger erupted after an overnight vote by Israel's far-right ruling coalition to limit judicial oversight. That anger spilled across the country. Protesters marched through Israel's main airport. They also blocked streets, even erected tents on a highway in central Israel. For more on what's unfolding there, we turn to reporter Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. What have you been seeing today, Noga? Are these protests bigger than previous ones? And after months of fairly sustained protests, what do these represent?
Well, it's hard to describe because it's been now 28 weeks of nonstop protests, and yet today feels like something of a juncture. The government last night passed a bill, which if it becomes law, would basically grant unscrutinized power to the government. The courts would have very little ability to make any commentary at all about any actions. And Israelis are fearful that this is what they're calling the first slice in the salami. One law that will begin to change Israel from a democracy into an autocratic regime.
So, Noga, this is a somewhat modified version of the judicial bill that prompted the outrage. How exactly is it different from the last iteration of the bill?
It's actually not different. It's a very, very harsh iteration. It's the same bill that was proposed initially in a very fiery press conference by the Minister of Justice last January. Then it was presented to the Knesset in March, and Israel erupted, and the first general strike in the nation's history took place. And Netanyahu then agreed to go to negotiations with the opposition. That eventually broke down a few weeks ago, and here we are again with the government unilaterally passing legislation that would completely and totally change the administrative structure of the state.
Does Prime Minister Netanyahu have the ability to push this one through?
He does, technically, and that's the direction he's going. He has 64 coalition votes out of 120 members of the Israeli parliament, so he could push this through, but it will likely bring the entire country to a stoppage like we saw last March. And so he's really on a tightrope, I'd say.
Can Israel's opposition do anything to stop this bill from being passed?
There are basically two oppositions right now in Israel. There's the parliamentary opposition that I think you're asking me about, and then there's the opposition in the streets. The parliamentary opposition has 56 votes as opposed to 64 for the coalition, but they're hoping to get some defectors. They're hoping that some members of Netanyahu's Likud party are going to get cold feet before this actually becomes law. And this, if it becomes law, will be very dramatic.
So finally, you said the committee hearings alone on this judicial bill could prompt even larger protests. What does happen with protests at this point?
I don't know. My guess is, though, that if the committee votes to approve this bill and it then moves to the Knesset plenary, I think the protests will be spontaneous and massive, like they were back in March when the defense minister was abruptly fired when he warned the cabinet that the army was falling apart. He's very close to that same situation now. He's in an awkward position because he himself supports this legislation, but he doesn't want to be stamped as the defense minister who broke up Israel's army. So we're waiting on that. The whole country, in a way, is holding its breath right now for the next few days.
Reporter Noga Tarnopolsky is based in Jerusalem and has been following the latest eruption of protests in Israel over the government's proposed judicial overhaul. Noga, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Say you're an aspiring young high school student looking to attend an American university, but your English is shaky at best. Language can often be a stumbling block to higher education, so why don't more universities in the U.S. embrace bilingual education, especially when there are 40 million Spanish speakers in the country? Elisa Baena of member station WLRN in Miami looked into that.
The United States doesn't have an official language and never has. Yet the de facto language of academia is English.
There's this trope in our country that being American means English only.
Melissa Baralt is a bilingual researcher and professor of psycholinguistics at Florida International University.
Most unfortunately, people who are in positions of power and policymaking often put forth these messages. And these messages are consistently that in order to succeed, you need to speak English.
But with the large number of Spanish speakers in the U.S. working in every field, some academics are questioning whether it makes sense for English to remain the primary language of higher education. Magda Castañera is the former director of the dual language program at Miami-Dade College, one of a few of its kind in the country. Students who are all honor students can take everything from biology to philosophy classes at the community college in Spanish.
It is a very specific niche program. You have to be bilingual. So we don't teach English, nor do we teach Spanish. And our whole goal is to have you stay bilingual.
The Miami-Dade College bilingual program has an impressive record. More than 75% of their students weren't born in the U.S., and nearly all will go on to graduate from the four-year school they transferred to. Last year, three dual language students who are recent immigrants transferred to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
I am the director for the Center for Bilingual Studies.
That's Joy Izquierdo from the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley.
We have one of the largest, if not the largest, bilingual education program in the country that produces bilingual teachers.
But future teachers are just one group they serve. They offer 485 courses that are either in Spanish or in both languages. Classes in biology, classes in engineering, serving a student body that is 90% Hispanic.
Our classes should reflect that. Our teaching needs to reflect that.
Izquierdo says that students still have the option of taking every class in English, but they can take advantage of learning in a bilingual setting if they want to.
If I want to be an accountant, and if I want to have clients that are native Spanish speakers or work internationally, it behooves them to take some of that accounting coursework. In Spanish, it's one thing to be bilingual, biliterate, just in general, like being able to read literature in Spanish and English. It's another thing to be bilingual, bicultural, biliterate in your field.
Even with tens of millions of Spanish speakers in the U.S., Miami-Dade College and the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley remain outliers. Here's Melissa Baralt again, the bilingual researcher from Florida International University.
We could be doing so much more in terms of promoting bilingualism. Why we're not investing in this is truly beside me.
But Magda Castañera of Miami-Dade College says other institutions have approached her to learn about the dual language program.
I think there's a lot of interest, but I think it takes a lot of thinking to establish how they're going to make this work in their communities.
Unfortunately, she says higher education moves very slowly. So while they've been doing this for two decades, she says the rest of the country still needs to catch up. For The World, I'm Elisa Baena.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Civil war, that's how the fighting in Sudan is now being described. The battle between two rival generals has escalated since it began in mid-April. It's stoking ethnic tensions, especially in the country's western Darfur region. That's leading some observers to suggest another term for Sudan's conflict, genocide. For more, we turn to Samantha Power, who heads up the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. It's keeping a close eye on the fighting while also trying to get humanitarian support to those who need it most. Administrator Power, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
So this week, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that Sudan is on the brink of a full-scale civil war that could destabilize the entire region of Northeast Africa. What's the latest you are hearing about the situation on the ground?
Every day we get new reports of flare-ups of fighting in different parts of the country. Darfur, of course, is an epicenter of violence right now, but so is the capital, Khartoum, which very few Sudanese could have imagined being racked by a civil war-like conflict as it is now. Additionally, we're getting reports of looting of humanitarian facilities. And if you think of the ultimate embodiment of brutality, imagine a militia that both kills, commits sexual violence, and actually loots wheat and ready-to-use therapeutic food for starving children. And that's what we're talking about here in terms of the depravity. It's also really tricky to get access to different parts of the country, so I can't claim to you that we have perfect knowledge by any stretch of the imagination across this vast country about where the needs are the most pressing. But we are trying to flow resources to trusted partners on the ground. This isn't the first time that Darfur has seen very significant violence. And so we do have relationships on the ground, and there are brave Sudanese and other international personnel who are there trying to meet the health, food, shelter, and other needs, but being able to do almost nothing to stem the violence.
So the violence is being perpetrated by two armies, the National Army and this rebel force, the Rapid Support Forces. Does it look as if civilians are siding with either general, giving this conflict a sectarian aspect, or do you see it as innocent civilians caught in the crossfire of two armies?
I would say largely the latter, with the added wrinkle that both the so-called RSF, the militia that you mentioned, and the Sudanese Armed Forces have, in many parts of the country, sought to mobilize tribes on their side.
Listeners will remember, Administrator Power, that before entering government, you were a prominent voice in the human rights community, focusing, among other crises, on Darfur, also a pioneer on what constitutes genocide. What are you seeing now in Darfur?
Well, I think until we get better access, it's going to be very hard to label or to reach some kind of assessment. But what we know is that targeted killings, ethnically motivated killings and attacks are occurring. And many of them are being perpetrated by the same individuals in some cases, and certainly the same militia that were active back in that horrible 2004 to 2005 period when genocide was perpetrated. I was in Eastern Chad back 20-something years ago when genocide was being perpetrated in Darfur, and I returned this past May, and it was just chilling in the extreme to meet with families who were crossing into Chad from Darfur, Sudan, and who were often crossing for the second, third, fourth time. And in one case, I met a mother whose son had been ripped from her arms and thrown into a fire. And I thought I was in a time warp, because those are exactly the kinds of stories that I heard back in 2004.
It sounds like you witnessed conditions there that possibly could lead to genocide.
We have to know what the intent of the perpetrators are, and we have to have a better sense of scale, but we already have evidence that executions are occurring, that sexual violence is being perpetrated, that internally displaced person camps, that those are being attacked.
UN officials have called Sudan the toughest place in the world for humanitarian workers. Why is that?
Mainly now, it's, of course, violence, mass violence, and popping up in very unpredictable ways. But there's also horrific bureaucracy. I know that sounds banal compared to what we've been talking about, but when you actually have bureaucrats who are looking for 10 permissions from various offices in order to allow a convoy to move from one part of the country with life-saving assistance in it to another part, it just compounds injury with insult, you might say. So we have been pressing, but because Sudan was in something of a governance limbo prior to the outbreak of fighting, because it had been on a path to civilian rule after years of dictatorship under Omar al-Bashir, who was indicted by the International Criminal Court. The people of Sudan rose up in 2018 in these popular female-led protests, brought down this dictatorship, and the AU helped facilitate a path to civilian rule.
The African Union.
That didn't last long, and those who felt themselves excluded launched a coup to undermine that. I mention all of this history because the will of the Sudanese people is being so defied again and again by these armed actors, but also it's actually very diffuse right now as to where the levers are to secure greater humanitarian access for these life-saving goods that are in some cases stuck in Port Sudan waiting to flow, but can't get a bureaucrat to sign off, in part because of a tradition of obstructionism.
So peace talks in Saudi Arabia have broken down. The U.S. and Saudi both seeing little productivity there. Egypt is playing some role, saying it'll host leaders from Sudan's neighbors on Thursday. Administrator Power, where do you see glimmers of hope for resolving the conflict peacefully?
Well, I think that the leadership shown in the last couple of days as well by Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia and President Ruto of Kenya is encouraging. So regional leadership efforts that also bring in the Arab-led process that the Saudis had been chairing on the humanitarian front in the town of Jeddah, we need these lines of effort to be proceeding in parallel. I will say also USAID does a lot with civilians on the ground. It was civilians who rose up and demanded the end of dictatorship. They were largely excluded from negotiations about Sudan's future after the coup. We are working hard on the ground to give them the support so they can self-organize. It's really important that civilian voices and women's voices be at the table, and that's not always what happens.
Finally, Administrator Power, you mentioned that trip to Chad you made in May, speaking with refugees escaping from Darfur and Sudan. Are there moments from that trip that stick with you today, maybe even haunt you?
For me, the most haunting aspect of this is knowing how many people are unable to get out of Sudan. When I met with those refugees coming into Chad from Sudan, what they talked about was lines, processions of people who were trying to get into Chad and were being blocked or attacked while attempting to flee. Mm. So it's really the people who we aren't able to access, who we know are in desperate circumstances and who are either bunkered in their homes or in displaced person camps, or being dressed down for bribes and have run out of money, who are dying of thirst, for all we know, in the very inhospitable conditions in Darfur. I think it is the unknown unknowns, and then knowing too much about who these perpetrators are and how they conduct themselves. It is that combination, I think, that is chilling in the extreme.
That's Samantha Power, the administrator for the U.S. Agency for International Development. Administrator Power, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for making time for this.
More stories still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. In Japan, there's a big difference between a carpenter and a carpenter who works on shrines. This artisan says there are hundreds of different ways to join wood and stone in a shrine, but craftspeople like him are aging and the push is on to train younger folks. Dowels instead of nails, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Depending on where you are right now, you could be experiencing severe heat or severe rainfall. This is the age of extreme weather, and it's obviously not isolated to the U.S.
Extreme heat is driving extreme rain in northern India.
There's no respite in Mexico from the sweltering heat wave.
Since the start of the weekend, heavy rainfall has lashed regions of southwest Japan, causing floods.
Climate scientists have long been warning that extreme, record-setting weather events could become the new normal as our planet warms. We turn now to Michael Mann with the Earth and Environmental Science Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Our Fragile Moment. Michael, you've been one of those people with some of the clearest warnings. What occurs to you as you look across the globe today?
Yeah, well, as a climate scientist, one of the last things that we want to see is our predictions coming true. But unfortunately, that's happening because we have failed at this point to take the actions necessary to avert some of the already catastrophic consequences, they're not subtle anymore. We're seeing them play out in the form of these unprecedented extreme weather events. The physics behind some of this is pretty basic. You know, you warm up the planet, you're going to get more frequent and intense heat waves. There's more moisture in the atmosphere and a warmer atmosphere. So when you do get rainfall, you get larger amounts of it, worse flooding events. But when, you know, in those intermittent periods, the hotter soils evaporate more moisture, so you get worse drought that combines with the heat and you get the sorts of wildfires that we've seen play out.
So can you take us on a quick tour of the places around the world where extreme weather events are occurring now that most alarm you, and places maybe where you see the outer limits of your projections?
Yeah, I mean, it would almost be easier right now to talk about the places that aren't seeing extreme weather right now. Here in North America, of course, we're seeing record heat. We had this heat dome that was parked over Texas and Mexico. We see the wildfires up in Canada where it's been unusually warm. And the sort of unusual jet stream pattern has actually meant that the winds have carried that Canadian smoke down into East Coast cities like the one I live in here, Philadelphia or New York City. Europe, they've seen extreme heat in the UK. India, record heat wave there, a number of fatalities, increasingly getting to sort of the danger point. We're starting to encounter this sort of combination of heat and humidity that is simply deadly.
What makes the current situation, Michael Mann, as you call it, a fragile moment? Is it simply about human beings' ability to deal with all of these conditions?
Yeah, in our fragile moment, I sort of go back in time and look at, you know, Earth history from the beginnings of our planet. It's this sort of delicate balance or, you know, there's this competition between sort of fragility and stability. There are episodes where we can see some of the stabilizing mechanisms on Earth's climate that keep it within livable bounds. But we also see episodes where these mechanisms spun out of control. The snowball Earth, when Earth was literally covered with ice. And so when you step back and you look at the collective evidence, there's a message of both urgency and agency. We can see that we're coming up against those bounds where we could well exceed sort of the envelope of climate that allows for the sustenance of human civilization. And yet we also see the agency. The lessons that we learn tell us that we're not there yet, that we can still avert truly catastrophic planetary warming, but not without dramatic and immediate efforts to reduce carbon emissions.
I was going to ask you, are you optimistic that the worst of climate change can be headed off, or are we moving too slowly?
I would say I'm stubbornly optimistic, cautiously or stubbornly optimistic, because the obstacles are not physical. That's what the climate record teaches us. They're not technological. We have the clean energy, renewable energy technology to decarbonize the machinery of our civilization. So those aren't the obstacles. The only obstacles right now are political ones. There's still time. We have a lot of work to do, though. We've got to reduce carbon emissions by 50% by 2030 if we are to prevent warming that really does now start to take us into that catastrophic level.
Michael Mann, you've been doing climate research for a long while and warning about the dangers. What is your level of frustration with governments that have pledged to deal with climate change?
Well, they're not doing enough. You know, we've seen some progress. The Inflation Reduction Act here signed into law by President Biden really does have the potential to make meaningful reductions in carbon emissions, moving us away towards renewable energy, providing various incentives to do that. The people who crunch those numbers tell us that the provisions of the IRA, if fully implemented, can reduce carbon emissions by about 40% by 2030. So the good news is that's a pretty big chunk. The bad news is it's not enough.
Michael Mann is a distinguished professor in the Earth and Environmental Science program at the University of Pennsylvania. His forthcoming book about these kinds of weather events as climate change nears its most serious tipping point is called Our Fragile Moment. Michael, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
In Japan, tourists are drawn to the country's noteworthy traditional craftsmanship. It's an especially important source of revenue for rural areas. But as those parts of Japan grapple with a rapidly shrinking population, finding new artisans to learn these crafts has become a challenge. From Western Japan, Tsunka Sirpala takes us on a tour of three towns looking for successors to carry on their traditions.
Japan is famous for its more than 100,000 sacred shrines and temples. The legendary Shokoji Temple in Toyama Prefecture, West Japan, dates back 600 years. It became a national cultural treasure last year for its magnificent temple roof and lavish decorations. Temple carpenters, called Miyadaiku, work behind the scenes maintaining them. Satoshi Funaki was one of the carpenters who helped restore Shokoji Temple. He shows me how Miyadaiku work without using nails or screws. There are hundreds of different ways to join wood and stone. The job of a Miyadaiku is to determine which one is the best fit for the structure and the material. In Japan, temples play a major role in important life events, but it's believed there are less than 100 people in the country who have the traditional knowledge to maintain them. Funaki is currently training 4 young people. One of them, 27-year-old Kohei Tamura, is approaching his final year as an apprentice. He tells me about the difference between a temple carpenter and a regular carpenter. A residential carpenter can use machines, but in temple restoration, there are so many parts that need to be done by hand. In neighboring Ishikawa Prefecture, local authorities have been busy trying to recruit apprentices for its highly prized gold leaf artisan technique. At the Kanazawa Yasue Gold Leaf Museum, I learn more about this ancient art. Gold leaf is real gold that has been beaten into an extremely thin, almost weightless sheet. It's used to decorate temples and shrines, and it's also used in luxury cosmetics, food and alcohol for decoration. A promotional video explains that Kanazawa City is the largest producer of gold leaf in Japan. Museum director Akitaka Kawakami says many countries make gold leaf, but they produce the thinnest.
This is a gold foil, thickness 1 micron. This foil doesn't have the same thickness everywhere. So small pieces are a little bit thicker. Large one is thinner.
2 years ago, this traditional technique was listed as a UNESCO World Intangible Cultural Heritage. Kazuya Kageyama is in charge of promoting Kanazawa City's cultural assets. He says compared to 20 years ago, the number of people producing gold leaf in the area has halved to just 15. The average age of an artisan is 70. In 2021, they launched a 3-year apprenticeship program in an effort to preserve the tradition. It's attracted 4 students so far. In our program, the apprentices work with master artisans 5 days a week in their studio, he says. With the support of our partner organizations, we want to continue to foster fresh talent. 25-year-old Mio Uketani said the 6-month trial period was rigorous, and the job itself requires a lot of manual labor. The special tools are heavy, and the materials are so delicate, she says. I'm still getting used to it. 55-year-old Naomi Takata also joined the Gold Leaf Apprenticeship Program. She says people see her differently now. When I tell people, they get so surprised, she tells me. They ask me if I have the strength to beat Gold Leaf. Takata is determined to make something of herself. She says the most daunting part is becoming a master in just 3 years. There is no point doing this if you can't sell the gold leaf you make. And I think it's going to take longer than the 3-year program. It might take 10 years, she says. But for me, I'm getting old, so I really have to speed things up. Back in neighboring Toyama, the prefecture has garnered a reputation as a pioneer of glass art. The Toyama Institute of Glass Art is the only public institution in Japan to offer advanced glass art studies. The school recruits international students and staff. Czech Republic glass expert Yaroslav Sara is associate professor at the school. He says the students face a tough future ahead.
Glass making will meet global challenges such as energy costs, ecology, recycling. Toyama, as long as the glass has big support from local government and also people, there is many artists living. I believe there is a big potential of making glass and glass art.
Back at Chokwaji Temple, the prayer hall is bustling with locals. Temple carpenter Funaki says he doesn't know who will take over his temple carpentry business. I haven't thought that far ahead, he says. It's hard to say. But it's no laughing matter. These ancient traditions are being held on by a small group of new successors. They carry the weight of these ancient techniques on their shoulders. For the world, I'm Tsanka Sirapala in Tokyo.
A few months ago, in April, India slid up from second place and overtook China to become the world's most populous country. Close to 40% of India's 1.4 billion people live in cities, cities that are increasingly segregated by caste and religion. New research details how that's impacting the upward mobility of residents. Reporter Raksha Kumar spoke with people in some of these segregated neighborhoods in Mumbai to learn more.
On a rainy July morning in Mumbai, some women gather around a water pipe in a narrow mud lane outside their houses. They argue over who gets how much water among them. 50-year-old Mamta Thakur tells me this is a weekly affair. Since they have access to clean water only once in 5 days, she says, neighbors fight every time it arrives. She belongs to what's called the other backward castes, or simply the middle castes. She lives in New Bhabrekar Nagar, an informal settlement that sits on the marshy beaches of the Arabian Sea. Thakur is lucky. She has access to clean drinking water at all. 8-year-old Bubbly lives nearby. She's from the Pardi community, one of the lowest in India's caste hierarchy. Her main job is to fetch water from a hand pump near her house. There is rarely any water there. And when there is water, it is contaminated. She doesn't go to school because no one in her family is literate. And there are no schools in her neighborhood. Social worker Sachin Nachnikar stands on a low wall that separates Thakur's and Bubbly's neighborhoods.
This is New Bhabrekar Nagar and this is Ambujwadi.
He explains that since the government recognizes Thakur's neighborhood as a slum, it is required to provide water, roads and electricity, even if it does a poor job of providing the facilities. But Bubbly's house is a large neighborhood called Ambujwadi that does not find itself on the city's map. Ambujwadi is a motley group of temporary shelters that houses more than 70,000 people, mostly from India's lowest castes and Muslims. Half of the road is eaten up by solid waste, garbage that people have thrown on the street. And the other half of the road is not constructed, so it's literally mud. Researchers say where you live in Indian cities like Mumbai mostly depends on which community you belong to and how rich you are. Mumbai is not without its fancy neighborhoods with tall buildings, roads with big cars, uninterrupted water supply, and massive shops flaunting big international brands. But then, most communities that get to occupy it have generations of privilege. Housing segregation here is deep-rooted and complicated, even though a typical Indian city is cosmopolitan.
It's cosmopolitan, it's diverse.
Naveen Bharti teaches at the Indian Institute of Technology, Bombay. He studies segregation in Indian cities.
They are cosmopolitan in that sense, in a sense that you have communities from across India, but across different castes and different religions, but they all stay in different segregated neighborhoods.
Historically, India was a mosaic of segregated villages spread out across the country. Even today, Indian villages are divided along caste lines. Over decades, though, the country saw many waves of urbanization. And every time, Bharti says, segregation patterns in rural India began to replicate themselves in the cities.
A particular people from Sangli want to migrate, and one person buys a plot in some region of Mumbai, outskirts of Mumbai. He or she will invite other people from his community to buy land around him. That also, in a way, increases segregation, results in segregation.
Religious violence is another reason for segregation. Mumbra, on the outskirts of Mumbai, has one of the largest concentrations of Muslims in India. Shireen Dalvi is a translator and publisher who lives in Mumbra. She says her young nieces and nephews have a tough time getting loans from banks or jobs when their resume says they live in Mumbra.
Mumbra ke naam pe naam dekhkar unko koi private job nahi dete ho. To jab unko job nahi dete.
Without access to good education, employment or credit, generations of people continue to remain marginalized, says Dalvi. Economist Sam Usher teaches at the Imperial College in London. He recently published a study on housing segregation in India that shows how it perpetuates inequality.
A neighborhood that's entirely Muslim is almost half as likely to have a government secondary school as a nearby neighborhood that has no Muslims in it.
His study also shows that access to health facilities are fewer in majority lower caste neighborhoods. India is one of the world's fastest growing economies. But researchers say the state needs to develop policies to encourage diverse neighborhoods so that the country sustains its rapid growth. For The World, I'm Raksha Kumar in Mumbai.
From the bowels of a deep ocean beast to the world's finest perfumeries, what a journey ambergris has been on. If you don't know what ambergris is, it's a hard, musky mass that builds up in the intestines of sperm whales. When the ambergris blob gets too big, the whales poop it into the sea. For centuries, this rich animal scent was used by perfumers to enhance their fragrances. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Spain on the latest find.
Last week, a sperm whale washed up dead on a beach in the Canary Islands. Marine veterinarian Antonio Fernandez was called in. As he poked around with gloved hands deep inside the mammal's intestines, his fingers bumped into something hard. A 20-pound chunk of ambergris, he told Spanish TV later, had obstructed the mammal's colon.
Lo que realmente mata al animal son las bacterias que se derivan.
The obstruction actually led to a bacterial infection that spread throughout the whale, he said. That's what killed it. Ambergris forms from hard bits of food that can accumulate in a whale's intestines, like shells or squid beaks. To protect itself from punctures, the whale excretes a wax-like substance that slowly encapsulates the mass.
¿Sabes como una perla? Yo la llamo un poquito también la perla del ambergris, para mí es una perla.
I call it the pearl of the sea, says classically trained perfumer Ramon Monegal, because that's how the ambergris forms. Ambergris has something other musks don't, he says. It's something noble. Monegal is one of the last remaining perfumers who actually used ambergris in his creations, for some 15 years. But in the 1980s, he dropped it, worried about sperm whales being slaughtered for it. For centuries, perfumers sought out ambergris as an indispensable base note for their fragrances. It has a deep, unique odor that hints of the sea, of something animal. Extracting its fragrance takes a long time. In his laboratory in the mountains of northeast Spain, Monegal is mixing handmade extracts and infusions in glass beakers. He remembers how he'd grind his coveted ambergris into a powder, then steep it in alcohol.
Que la dejábamos envejecer macerando. La nuestra tenía 10 años.
We'd age it for up to 10 years, Monegal says, like a fine rum, but a bit more expensive. An ounce of ambergris fetches about $2,000. Some Yemeni fishermen found a chunk of ambergris in 2021. The smell wasn't very nice, one told the BBC, but it was a lot of money. The fishermen sold it for about $1.5 million. The ambergris just found in Spain is worth about $500,000. Only one in about 100 sperm whales develop ambergris. People used to hunt the whales for the potential treasure. Sperm whales are now a protected species. But if you find ambergris, say, on a beach or floating at sea, it is legal to buy and sell. Like Monegal, most perfumers no longer use ambergris. There's the concern for whale welfare, but it's also just too expensive.
Cuando empieza a aparecer y empiezan a salir la eau de parfum, la eau de toilette, la eau de cologne.
These days, the market is flooded with cheap cologne, Monegal says, and we got priced out. So who buys ambergris now? Someone with money to burn, Monegal surmises, and a perfumer somewhere still willing to work with the controversial excretion. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Santa Coloma de Farmes, Spain.
Here's something you may not have known about Mexico. It's one of the world's top producers of salt. Most production is done industrially in large areas near the coast, but a handful of salt makers cling to their ancestral traditions passed down from generation to generation, going back some 2,000 years. That artisanal approach is a dying art, and many fear that climate change and migration are threatening it even further. Reporter Michael Fox has more from the town of Zapotitlan Salinas in central Mexico.
The sun isn't fully up, but Pedro Sales Diaz is already hard at work. He's wearing jeans and a red checkered plaid shirt, and he's carrying 100-pound sacks of salt down the hillside to be stored for sale. He navigates his way along the rock walls that separate hundreds of small pools that line the cactus-studded hill, pools that have been here for centuries.
Ya venimos trabajando de generación tras generación. Era de mi abuelo, era de mi papá, ya vengo yo.
This has been passed down from generation to generation, he says, from my grandfather to my father, and now me. Salas Diaz works alongside his father. He is one of the youngest and one of only about 100 traditional salt farmers left here. Visiting this salt farm is like stepping back in time. Even they don't know how many hundreds of years ago the stairs and the rock walls of the mineral springs were built. Their salt farming technique has remained roughly the same for generations. They use the spring water to fill the salt pools. It can take 2 months of watering, washing, rewashing, and breaking up the crystals for each pool to produce a few hundred pounds of salt. Back before industrialized production, the salt here was a coveted commodity. They called it white gold. The indigenous Popoloca peoples produced and traded it widely long before the arrival of the Spanish. Those days are over, but it's still a huge source of pride for the local community.
Para nosotros es la identidad, porque a nivel nacional hay varios...
It's our identity, says local tour guide Leonardo Noé. Our town is named Zapotitlan Salinas, or Zapotitlan of the salt farms. It's our unique identity and puts us on the map, he says. In town, huge baskets holding bags of salt sit outside the shop of resident Marcelo Salas. When I opened this store, the first thing I wanted to do was sell this salt, because it's part of our culture, Salas says. We sell about a ton of it a week. Across the street, Maria del Carmen Cruzales owns and runs a taco shop. We are the children of salt farmers, she says. And there is a huge difference between refined salt and the salt we produce here. Our salt gives another flavor to the meat and the sauces. Their salt is also good for you. A recent study from a local university found that it has 65% less sodium and is rich with 200 minerals. That's because this whole region used to be underwater. The ancient sea left behind salt and minerals, which the rains collect when they fall during the summer months and replenish the mineral springs that feed the salt farms. But farmer Pedro Sales Diaz says those springs aren't filling up like they used to, and he's concerned for the future. With climate change, there are times when it's not supposed to rain and it does, and times when it's supposed to rain when it doesn't. It's very concerning, he says. But Sales Diaz says they will weather the storm, and when his toddler son is ready, he'll be bringing him along too, teaching him the trade that he learned from his father and his grandfather before him. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Zapotitlan Salinas, Mexico.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.